Hello and welcome to Yesterday's News, the podcast that brings you the biggest stories from this week in history. I'm Joe Forrester and I'll be guiding you through the historical headlines from the earth-shattering to the absurd. You can follow the show at Very Old News and please do get involved. No tweet is too trivial for our attention. On with the show. First up, India and the world mourn the loss of a great man. Next, we follow the extraordinary journey of Oliver Cromwell's disembodied head. And finally, a young man unjustly loses his life in 1950s England. First up, it's the 30th of January 1948, and we have sad news from New Delhi, where Indian independence leader Mahatma Gandhi has been assassinated. Gandhi was on the steps here outside Birla House in New Delhi, where a crowd was gathered, and he was about to hold a prayer meeting. It was then that a man approached from the crowd and shot him three times at close range. Gandhi was taken back inside, but died shortly after. The assassin was Nathuram Godse, a 37-year-old Hindu nationalist who disagreed with Gandhi's acceptance of Muslim Indians and their desire for a separate Islamic state of Pakistan. Godse was apprehended, tried, and then hanged in 1949. The day of the shooting, Gandhi's protege Jawaharlal Nehru made the announcement on Indian radio.
The light has gone out of our lives and there is darkness everywhere. And I do not quite know what to tell you and how to say it. Our beloved leader, Bapu as we called him, the father of the nation, is no more. Perhaps I am wrong to say that. Nevertheless, we will not see him again as we have seen him for these many years. We will not run to him for advice and seek solace from him. And that is a terrible blow, not to me only, but to millions and millions in this country.
Gandhi's legacy is an extraordinary one. Having studied at Cambridge University in England, Gandhi struggled to find work as a lawyer in his native India, so in 1896 moved to South Africa to take up a position there. It was in South Africa that young Mohandas, oh yes, we'll get to the name thing later, had something of an awakening, after being thrown out of a first-class carriage on a train for being Indian. Imagine what a different place the world might have been had that ticket inspector not been such a douche. Gandhi's campaigns in South Africa centred around the rights of Indians to vote, and he organised his first acts of peaceful mass civil disobedience, successfully negotiating with the government before moving back to India in 1914 to tackle the much larger problem of British colonial rule. He introduced his philosophy of Satyagraha, a form of non-violent resistance, and while he supported the British during the First World War, he protested against the mandatory draft of Indians into military service in 1919, and hundreds of thousands answered his call. He was now the leader of the Indian independence movement. He then organised boycotts of British goods and services in India, but called off his campaigns amid violence in 1922, when he was also arrested by the British for sedition and imprisoned. He was released 2 years later and led a fast against Hindu-Muslim violence. However, it was in 1930 that his most famous act of civil disobedience took place, as he led a march over 24 days and 240 miles, accruing hundreds of thousands of followers en route to the Arabian Sea. The purpose was to protest against the British salt tax, which directly impacted the poor workers who produced it. When they reached the sea, Gandhi and his followers sieved the mineral and he, along with 60,000 others, were arrested. However, the world was paying attention. After a brief release to attend talks in London in 1931, Gandhi was imprisoned in India again and led protests to support the position of the Untouchables caste, the lowest group on India's social ladder. He went on to support the British in the Second World War, hoping to exchange that support for Indian independence after the conflict. In 1942, his campaign calling for a complete British withdrawal from India saw him imprisoned once more. He would remain in jail until 1944. However, in 1945, with a new British government in place and the war over, Gandhi was released and talks began over a free India. However, ever-present tensions between Hindus and Muslims meant there was widespread support for two separate states, and the violence between the two groups was a source of great pain to Gandhi. The British agreed to create the two new independent states of India and Pakistan on the 15th of August 1947. Gandhi held fasts and prayer meetings all over India in an attempt to end the violence, and it was at one of these meetings in January 1948 that he was shot and killed by nationalist fanatic Godse. Gandhi's funeral was held the day after the shooting, on the 31st of January 1948, with millions in attendance. Gandhi is one of the outstanding figures of the 20th century and arguably all recorded history. His message of peaceful, non-violent resistance is still a touchstone today, and he was a great influence on other cultural and political leaders, most notably Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in his struggle for civil rights in America. While he was born Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, the name he was known by was Mahatma, meaning the great soul. A fitting moniker for a true icon. Next up, it's the 30th of January 1661, and you join us at Tyburn, London, where the Lord Protector of England, Oliver Cromwell, is about to be executed. The problem? He's already dead. There are crowds of onlookers present as the body of the Lord Protector is being brought to the gallows. Right, they're wrenching it up, and oh my God, oh, it's seen better days, let me tell you. One lady's just been sick in her handbag. Here we go, the executioner is ready. There you have it, the end, kind of Oliver Cromwell. In 1658, 9 years after the execution of Charles I and 5 years after becoming Lord Protector, Oliver Cromwell died. His magnificent funeral was a regal affair witnessed by thousands and drew on all the trappings of state. Just like in life, Cromwell was king in all but name. His death left a vacuum that his son Richard Cromwell attempted and failed to fill, and after only 9 months, he was booted out of a job. This cleared the way for Charles II to return the monarchy to England. However, Charles, rather incongruously for the king who brought back partying, was filled with murderous rage, and he wanted revenge for his father's execution. He ordered the surviving signatories to his father's death warrant to be hanged, and then asked that chief among the regicides, Oliver Cromwell, face the same punishment, despite the fact he'd been dead for 3 years. And so on the 30th of January 1661, Cromwell was dug up and had his head cut off. His headless body was then buried in a grave under the gallows, and his head was dipped in tar in order to preserve it before being impaled on a 20-foot-tall traitor's pole and displayed on the roof of Westminster Hall, together with the heads of two other regicides who'd been co-signatories to the death warrant of Charles I, John Bradshaw and Henry Ireton, Cromwell's son-in-law, and who also had been posthumously punished. They formed a macabre warning to anyone thinking about turning against the monarchy, and Cromwell's head remained atop the building for at least 25 years, an eerie human weather vane whipped by wind, lashed by rain and bronzed by the sun in the centre of London, considered one of the most advanced and forward-thinking cities in the world at the time. It was removed briefly for maintenance in 1681, then one day in a fierce storm towards the end of the 1680s, the pole the head was impaled on snapped. Cromwell's head rolled into a gutter and was apparently found by a soldier who promptly took it home, as you would, and secreted it in a chimney corner. When Cromwell's skull was discovered to be missing, there was a huge outcry. But the head did not re-emerge for another 25 years or so. According to Jonathan Fitzgibbons, a man with one of the most unusual jobs ever, he's the biographer of Cromwell's head, he stated that tradition has it that the sentry who found the head had harboured Republican sympathies and hid Cromwell's severed bonds like a holy relic in his home, revealing its existence only on his deathbed. His daughter later sold what was by now presumably a pretty manky, worm-eaten old thing, and during the 18th century it passed through the hands of various entrepreneurs and showmen who thought, mistakenly, that they could make their fortune by exhibiting this curiosity, which still had part of the spike rammed through the skull. This included in 1789 James Cox, who paid the comic actor Samuel Russell £118 for it. Cox did go on to make a profit, selling it for £230 to three brothers who put it on public display in London in 1799, but barely sold a single ticket. Then in 1841, Cromwell's head was bought by Mr. Josiah Wilkinson. It stayed in Wilkinson's family and remained out of public view, but his descendant, the Canon Horace Wilkinson, did allow it to be inspected by two scientists in 1934. They described the head as being embalmed, very shrivelled, but still showing a depression on the site of the famous wart that Cromwell had always insisted his portrait painters depict faithfully and that appears on his death mask. The marks of the axe used to sever the head from the body were also apparent. X-rays confirmed that it was the skull of a man of about 60, Cromwell's age at death. The conclusion was that it was authentic. Naturally, this caused Canon Wilkinson some ethical concern. What on earth should you do with the severed head of a former head of state? He was apparently reluctant to give it to a museum on the grounds that it constituted Christian remains and descendants of Cromwell were still living. Something that Cromwell, a deeply pious man, I'm sure would have appreciated. Uncertain exactly what to do, the canon is said to have popped it on his mantelpiece. In 1960, following his death, his son, also called Horace, wished to arrange a proper burial, so he contacted Sidney Sussex College, Cambridge, where Cromwell had once briefly studied. In a strange final chapter and after some debate, the college decided to bury the head in a secret location during a clandestine ceremony. A plaque close to the burial site commemorates the curious interment on the 25th of March 1960, somewhere within the antechapel at the college. The precise spot was left unmarked. Oliver Cromwell's well-travelled head could finally be left in peace. Finally, it's the 28th of January 1953, and Joe Forrester is live outside Wandsworth Prison in London, where protests against the sentencing of a young man have gone unheeded.
That's right, Joe. Teenager Derek Bendley has been executed here today at Wandsworth Prison in London for his part in the murder of PC Sidney Miles. The 19-year-old was hanged at 0900 hours after last-minute appeals for clemency were rejected. Bendley was sentenced to death on the 11th of December last year for killing PC Miles during a bungled break-in at a warehouse in Croydon, Surrey. The court was told his co-defendant, Christopher Craig, fired the fatal shot, but because he was still a juvenile in the eyes of the law, he escaped the death sentence and was ordered to be detained at Her Majesty's pleasure. A large crowd began gathering outside Wandsworth Jail from early this morning. Some sang the hymn Abide With Me and the 23rd Psalm. Others began booing when a prison warder came out carrying a glass-covered board containing the execution notice. Bendley's sentence was sealed last night when the Home Secretary, Sir David Maxwell Fyfe, said he could not see any reason for intervening in the case. A deputation of MPs had earlier gone to see the Home Secretary with a petition said to have been signed by about 200 members. They urged him to ask the Queen to exercise her royal prerogative of mercy. They pointed out Craig was the ringleader of the two, and that Bentley's mental age was probably younger, in fact, than his partner, a fact that had not been disclosed to the jury. They also claimed major public support for a reprieve. But the Home Secretary said he could see no grounds for modifying the sentence. Earlier, he had written to Bentley's parents saying the same thing. A crowd of up to 300 gathered outside the Houses of Parliament last night, chanting Bentley must not die. The demonstrators marched to the Home Office and later to Downing Street. The crowd eventually dispersed in the early hours of this morning after handing in a petition at Deputy Prime Minister Anthony Eden's home. Bentley's execution comes just 3 months after the warehouse break-in in Croydon, in which PC Miles died. Bentley was convicted on the basis of police evidence. Three officers told the court they had heard him encourage Craig to shoot by shouting, "Let him have it." Bentley's defence claimed he was already under arrest at the time the shots were fired and was simply urging Craig to give up his gun. That was taken from the original newspaper report in 1953. In 1998, 45 years after his execution, Derek Bentley was granted a full pardon, and his case, centering on spurious evidence open to interpretation, and where a man of diminished mental capacity was tried with the full weight of the law, became a major milestone in the journey towards the abolition of capital punishment in Britain. So there you have it, that's it for this week's stories, and before we finish, let's have a look at some other headlines from this week in history. On the 28th of January in 1547, a 9-year-old Edward VI succeeded Henry VIII as King of England. In 1813, Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice is published in the United Kingdom. On the 29th in 1595, Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet is thought to have first been performed. On the 30th of January 1883, the England cricket team were presented with the Ashes of a Bale after a test match against Australia in Sydney. This is where we get the Ashes series from. In 1933, President Paul von Hindenburg appointed Adolf Hitler as Reich Chancellor of Germany. Imagine that, having a right-wing firebrand appointed legally and democratically. In 1958, the House of Lords passed a bill allowing women to take seats. In 1955 was the state funeral of Winston Churchill, the biggest ever. In 2000, family GP Dr. Harold Shipman was jailed for life for murdering 15 of his patients, making him Britain's most prolific convicted serial killer. On the 1st of February 1968, Saigon Police Chief Nguyen Ngoc Loan executed Viet Cong officer Nguyen Van Lem with a pistol shot to the head in one of the most famous images of the Vietnam War. The execution was captured by photographer Eddie Adams and became an anti-war icon. And the 3rd of January 1959 was known as the Day the Music Died, when a plane crash killed musicians Buddy Holly, Richie Valens and J.P. Richardson, plus their pilot, near Clear Lake, Iowa. And to finish, we normally do an idiom, but as we remember the life of Mahatma Gandhi, I thought it would be quite apposite to have some of Gandhi's most famous quotes, things that seem particularly relevant today. You must be the change you wish to see in the world. An eye for an eye only ends up making the whole world blind. Live as if you were to die tomorrow. Learn as if you were to live forever. The best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And this is my favourite. You must not lose faith in humanity. Humanity is an ocean. If a few drops of the ocean are dirty, the ocean does not become dirty. So that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. And remember, you can follow the podcast on Twitter @VeryOldNews. And please do get in touch. And I will chat to you next week.